Tired of the price of everything going up these days? Groceries, rent, you name it. It's all going up. But not at Metro. They've got your back. Metro has lowered their prices and are giving you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. One line? Now 20% lower. Family plans? Also lowered. Oh, and you also get a free 5G phone. All with no ID required and no activation fees. Stop by your neighborhood Metro store, visit metrobytmobile.com, or call to find out about their amazing offers. Bring your number, not available if currently at T-Mobile or with Metro in the past 180 days. Guarantee covers monthly price of on-network talk, text, and 5G data for customers activating on an eligible plan. Exclusions apply. Details at metrobytmobile.com.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365 because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Final seconds, no fouls to give. Halliburton looking. Halliburton driving. Pulls off. Jump shot. It's gone! It's gone! With 0.3 seconds remaining. Timeout, OKC. Tyrese Halliburton does it again.
And that was the scene Thursday night as Tyrese Halliburton worked his magic once again, helping the Indiana Pacers steal game one of the NBA Finals in Oklahoma City, a result that certainly did not seem like it was in the offing when OKC was up comfortably 15 points in the fourth quarter. All you could think is, well, the Thunder are not the Knicks. Turns out they actually kind of were Thursday night as the Pacers pulled off yet another miracle comeback. And that's where we begin the new edition of the Sports Media Watch podcast. I'm John Lewis, joined as always by Armand Brody. Please subscribe to the SMW podcast feed and Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more for more of us and our discussions of everything in sports media over these past several weeks. So let's just start with obviously best case scenario for the NBA in game one. And that would be a Pacers victory in an exciting fashion. The first NBA Finals opener decided by single digits. So not even by one, but by single digits at all since 2019, which just tells you a lot about kind of how uninteresting the Finals has been these past several years. This was, you know, certainly it didn't feel like a classic for the first three quarters, especially with Indiana turning the ball over as much as it did, but it ended up being a very memorable game. Well, the game was great, but the game one numbers have come in much lower, I think, than certainly my expectations. And my expectations were not particularly high. 8.91 million viewers for game one. That is the least watched game one of the finals other than the two COVID-affected years of 2020 and 2021. It's lower than we saw with the Cavs and the Spurs in 2007 and Nets and Spurs in 2003. My thought was going to be around 10 million, not necessarily a ratings bonanza, but certainly higher than 8.9. The one good thing if you're the league is that the close finish did translate into a bigger tune-in at the end. The final two quarter hours were both higher than the final quarter hour last year. This game went a little bit longer, so it spilled into an additional quarter hour compared to last year. And 11.1 million viewers were watching during the period in which Tyrese Halliburton hit the game winner. So that's a nice solid sampling of 11.1 million, nothing massive or anything. But if you can get those people to tune back in for game two, then maybe you can see these numbers improve a bit. Armand, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would encourage folks to check out the great chart you put together with the quarter hour viewership comparison from last year, game one, to this year. It reminds me of the conversation we had about Indiana, New York, and the ratings that we saw there. Had some close games early in that series, of course, and the numbers just didn't quite get to where we thought they might. I don't think the conversation here is about market size. I just think expectations for this series were not, for game one in particular, were not very high. But I do think that the NBA should at least be encouraged by the fact that during crunch time, when things really got intense, people were watching. And so it's almost like, well, how do you want to look at this, glass half empty or glass half full? Yeah, the 8.9 million number might be a little jarring to some, but I do think there should be some encouragement taken from the league in the sense that when the game was on the line, when things were, when the drama was at its peak, at its zenith, people were interested. And hopefully, as you pointed out on Richard Deitch's podcast, if you get a long series and if you get this kind of drama, maybe we do game six, game seven, hopefully. Maybe we start to really see some really encouraging numbers going forward. But I guess I'm trying to think, because I'm weighing both these thoughts, you know, in my head at the same time. 8.9 million is not an encouraging number, but do fans really know these players? Do fans, do casual fans know Tyrese Haliburton? Do casual fans know Shai Gilgeous-Alexander? This is an opportunity for the NBA to showcase these young players. And because of the kind of drama and the kind of intrigue that you now have going into game two, I would expect some momentum and some improved numbers going forward, especially if the series goes deep.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just a simple reality as well. In the 2020s, a 4.7 rating is no longer a shocking number for the NBA Finals or even for the World Series, and not just during COVID. It is what it is. You can get ratings that are under 5 for these properties where it used to be that a horrible number was in the 6 range. Now those are pretty good. You'll take a 6. So it is what it is. I certainly think that the NBA has got to figure, I mean, maybe it doesn't. Maybe the NBA doesn't have to figure out how to turn it around. I mean, obviously, we see what the media rights money is. Maybe it doesn't matter at all how the finals does if you're making $7 billion a year from your new partners. But certainly, for the PR of it, it would certainly be probably a good thing for the NBA to get back to where the finals is getting. I mean, not even 16, 17 million, but, 13 million. Get back to those numbers from the Warriors and Raptors that seemed so terrible back in 2019. And I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. What? 13 million? What's going on here? Those would be really nice to see now for the NBA, certainly. But if you had asked me in 2019, what do you think a Pacers-Thunder finals would draw? And you said, and keep in mind, it's 2019. So not Durant, not Westbrook, not Paul George. I'd probably guess, I mean, I don't think I'd guess under 9 million in 2019, but I'd probably guess something within range of that, which is probably closer to what my original prediction was, around 10 million, I think. Because that, to me, 10 million, that's a number where it's low, but it's not record low setting. I did not see record low setting as in the cards for this series. Even though, obviously, it's not really a record low because of the COVID years, but, you exclude those.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about this as well. Should we be, not disappointed, disappointed's not the right word, but Indiana, New York had so much drama. Should we have thought, John, that that would have been enough? The drama from the residue from Indiana, New York, because Oklahoma City, Minnesota obviously did not give it to you. Should we have thought that some of the drama from New York, Indiana would have carried us into a game one number that looks a little more promising? Or were we reaching? Was I reaching too much by maybe making that kind of an assumption?
I think maybe if Indiana and New York had gone 7, one, that would have cut down the number of days before the finals. Two, you would have had a bigger audience that watched the most recent game and came back for the next one. I think that has to have helped in terms of Miami-Denver 2 years ago, that going to the 7th game. Miami-Denver 2 years ago, now it looks like 1998 or something in terms of their ratings. I can't understand how Miami-Denver did that well, because I can't believe that the gap between Miami-Denver and Indiana-OKC is 3 million viewers. I just can't believe that. Now, the 2023 playoffs did great in the ratings. That was a tremendous year for the NBA. Easily the best year ratings-wise the NBA has had since the COVID pause. And maybe the momentum also carried in just from the playoffs. Maybe Jokic is a bigger star than we think. Maybe Butler is a bigger star than we think. And definitely Denver and Miami are much bigger markets than Indiana and OKC. So that might have played a role there too. The NBA chose to have a team in Oklahoma City. The NBA chose to have the parity that it has. And this was always a possibility with that. The leagues are choosing to put themselves in situations where the ratings might not be good. And it doesn't really seem like too many of them, whether it's the NBA, the NHL, even NASCAR, it doesn't really seem like any of them are particularly concerned about it. And given the TV money, it's hard to blame them for their lack of concern.
Let me ask you this, because we'll have the weekend to have some of these discussions go on, and then game two will happen on Sunday night. And we have to assume, of course, that's never a safe thing, but we would have to assume that given the drama of the end of game one, that the number would be better. Is that a safe assumption to make? I would think so, John.
Because remember when Oklahoma City lost game one to Denver, they won game two by 43. And so there's just, if it's a blowout, it's not going to be better. So just like with game one only buys you extra curiosity in that first quarter hour. But what sustains the audience is it a good game? How do you get that tune in, that jump from 9 million to 11 million, where 2 million more viewers tuned in from 10:30 to 11 o'clock? How do you get that to happen a lot earlier in the game? Right? I mean, that's the key. How do you get that to happen a lot earlier in the game? I don't know how. Because you don't know that Indiana's going to do this every game. Although, frankly, they kind of have. But you don't know that they're going to do it every game. And if a game looks like it's a blowout, you might not tune in. So the Pacers, it's going to have to really be a tight back-and-forth game to make a big difference. I will say this, though. In Pacers-Knicks, game one, honestly, was underwhelming to me. I know it was the most watched game one since 2018 in the East. But the game was so good. I mean, the final minutes were so amazing. And it went overtime, which actually helped a lot, too, because that's more time for that elevated audience. Then every other game did better than game one. The audience never dipped below game one for the rest of that series, not even for the games that were lopsided. That, to me, is what you're hoping you get. Obviously, this finals is going to be down. Unless it goes seven, there's no way you're beating last year's average, which wasn't even any good. But you're not beating that with a start like this. So really now it's kind of just managing the damage and getting what kind of audience you can get. And if you can find a way to get a few of these games to be really, really tight, not just the Pacers were getting their derrieres kicked and then just turned it on for an incredible comeback in the final minutes. Because if the Pacers wait till the very end of the game to compete, the viewers are going to wait till the very end of the game to tune in. And so it's going to be very important that these games be good from start to finish, back and forth, exciting, which frankly, the Pacers haven't done a lot of in this postseason.
Right. That's what I was about to say. It seems like this series needs sustained drama. Not late game heroics, not late game drama, sustained drama. You need a tension from beginning to end where the game is within, 6-7 points the entire way, seesaw back and forth, and then hoping that you get a continuation of that drama from quarters 1 through 3 that just carries over into quarter 4. I'm fascinated by the fact that you had this massive increase from that 10:30, 10:45 window until the end of the game. Because, I mean, it says it all. And I, once again, I encourage folks to go look at the chart that John has on X. It says it all. It says we don't care about this game until it's late. Now, I don't know if that's because of the players involved, or if it was because it was assumed that the Thunder would just take care of the Pacers in game one. But whatever the reason, the fans spoke up and said, give us a reason to care about this game. And perhaps they're saying, give us a reason to care about this series, but do it earlier. And so the question now, and I just have a feeling based on what we've seen from these two teams, it is entirely possible, as you said, John, that the Thunder come out here in game two and win by 30, 35, which would be crippling to the NBA and crippling to the ratings number, would not be encouraging at all. But I can see that happening. I hope it doesn't. But based on what we've seen from the NBA in previous years and based on what we've seen, the inconsistencies of the Thunder and the Pacers in this postseason alone, it is entirely possible that we get a game two that looks nothing like game one. And then we're having these same arguments all over again about where the league is and about Adam Silver did this and about, oh, the league's in trouble and oh, small market and all of the things. So I'm hopeful, but I'm not terribly optimistic about what could happen from a rating standpoint going forward in this series, because I don't trust that we'll get sustained drama, the kind of sustained drama that we need to keep fans interested from tip off until the final buzzer.
The NBA's gotten lucky most of the time. So obviously all the years, LeBron made the finals 8 straight years and 9 out of 10. And some of those years didn't do well, but LeBron in the finals, 8 straight years, played Golden State 4 straight times. You had Kobe and the Lakers versus the Celtics twice in 3 years. You had a three-peat with the Lakers. You know what NBC had every single year? Michael Jordan or the Knicks or the Lakers or Shaq. Every single year for 12 years. CBS had 3 Celtics-Lakers series, 3 Sixers-Lakers series. And the only year that they didn't get a good matchup was their last year, Detroit and Portland. The NBA has never really had a run like this in the ratings era. There's no reliable ratings from the 70s. But this is the 70s in a lot of ways for the NBA. Parity for the NBA is not great in terms of ratings and popularity. This is just the way it's going to be until you get back into a more dynastic superstar state. And it's not the worst place in the world to be. You know, it's not great. But to be completely honest, I don't see this being any different than about 20 years ago when they had the Spurs against the Nets, the Spurs against the Pistons. Those numbers were higher. And that's without out-of-home viewing and with a smaller population. But just generally, if the NBA doesn't have the stars, the familiar teams, you're going to see viewership that's at best 9 to 10 million. And by that standard, these numbers are off pace, but about in line.
The comparisons to Rangers Diamondbacks from MLB, is that fair, John?
Yeah.
To mention this in the same breath as that?
Absolutely. And, you know, Rangers Diamondbacks actually did better in game one than this with over 9 million. But 2, 3, and 4 were all under 9 million. So this is in line with what we saw for a lot of that series. It is what it is, man. I mean, what can you do? You can't make people interested.
Right.
You can't make people want to watch. We saw Rangers Diamondbacks, 9 million. Very next year, Yankees Dodgers game one, what was it, 15 million right off the bat? What are we supposed to be mad at people? How dare you not watch when it's these two less popular teams? You're not a real ball lover. Okay. Most people aren't. And I mean, nobody is obligated to sit down and watch teams they're uninterested in. You know, there's no moral failing on the part of the people who didn't tune in. They just weren't interested. They had other things to do. Somebody asked me, hey, do you think the Elon Trump stuff affected the ratings? And no, I truly do not. But that was, until Tyrese hit that shot, that was a heck of a lot more interesting yesterday than the game. So, I mean, I can't sit down and blame people for not tuning in. I think we've had enough of that. This weird elitism on social media where people get mad if folks aren't tuning in for Rangers Diamondbacks or Pacers Thunder. Generally, when you don't have the normal teams, people, they aren't interested.
You're so right. And I think even back to Adam Silver's appearance on Breakfast Ball, he was trying to compare Indiana OKC to Green Bay and Pittsburgh. And I was like, no, that's not it, Adam. That's not it. But the point you make is so important. There's no moral obligation to watch these games. And if you don't want to watch, you don't watch. I mean, it's that simple. And people did not watch. Not as many people watched as maybe the NBA wanted, of course, or fans of the league wanted. But if you are a fan of the league, if you are a fan, no matter who plays, no matter if it's Wizards Hornets or if it's Lakers Celtics, if you just love basketball, you're just going to watch, that's fine. But understand that when we get to these championship events, now you're expanding and you're hoping to reach out to a broader audience to have more casual fans watching the sport. And if they don't know, if they don't have a connection to Tyrese Haliburton, if they don't have a connection to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, if they don't have a connection to Jalen Williams or to Andrew Nembhard, then it's going to be more difficult to get people to watch. But it doesn't mean they're bad people. It doesn't mean they're enemies of the sport. It just means that there are other things going on in life and there's not enough happening in the series to grab their attention. And that's life.
Well, you know, the other thing too, Packers, Steelers, obviously two of the great NFL teams. The NFL does have matchups that would be like this. Jacksonville, anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jacksonville versus Carolina would not do well by Super Bowl standards.
Right.
Okay, so, I mean, I don't know why Adam Silver does, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about the breakfast ball thing a little bit later, but I don't get any of it. The simple reality is people want to see familiar games, familiar teams, and it would be wonderful for the NBA if the health of a league was such that simply being the NBA Finals meant a certain number of people were going to tune in. But frankly, that is true. And that certain number of people is like 7 to 8 million. We have kind of pared down the audience to the core in this decade, where you see, okay, there is a core audience where you can put the NBA Finals on in October opposite football, and you'll still get this 6 million viewers who tuned in for Game 3 of Lakers Heat in the bubble, right? That's your core audience. But we don't even know if that's true. Still had LeBron and the Lakers in it. You have OKC Indiana in that bubble. I mean, look out. I mean, that would have been very interesting. Or, you know, to use a more accurate 2020 example, if it had been Clippers Bucks, which a lot of people thought would be the finals that year. So this is just where the NBA is. It's still good enough for them to have gotten the money they got. What do you say? The ratings obviously really are very dependent on certain teams, certain stars, certain storylines, and the league without those, stripped totally just to the ball, is not necessarily what I think people might have expected 10 years ago. But if you go back far enough, this is a league that in 2003, and yes, no out-of-home viewing, yes, you know, you had a smaller population. There were a lot more people watching TV back in 2003, too. Back in 2003, 22 years ago, that first finals game, 9.6 million. This is within a million viewers of that, again, out-of-home viewing population growth. That tells me that the NBA's kind of been at this point for a while. And all that happened was it got every single hit it needed for most of the past 20 years. And since that magic has worn off, the league is just kind of right back where it was in 2003.
And I just want to make this point as well, because you have those people who would say, well, the game was so good shouldn't a high quality game, especially with that kind of ending, shouldn't it have a better number? But that's not quite how it works, right? Like, and this is why the quarter hour chart is helpful and instructive and informative for us, because what championship events do, or what they can do, is sort of really give you a gauge for how much sort of the average Joe cares about your product as a whole. You know, the All-Star games and your championship events, they can provide some sort of idea. Obviously, it's not 100%, but just some sort of idea about how much are we moving the needle? Some idea. And so when you put Indiana and OKC in the finals with unknown, unproven stars, it's why you have the conversations about, well, is SGA a megastar and all the things. And it's why I think the NBA was trying to lean so heavily, at least the media was trying to lean so heavily into Anthony Edwards, because they're looking for somebody to market. They're looking for somebody to put in front of the people and say, watch this guy, watch this player, trust this team, depend on the drama that you're going to get when you put these players out here on this stage. But even with a close matchup, even with a game that had a scintillating ending, Indiana OKC are not going to move the needle just by themselves, by the names of those teams, those franchises, and the players involved, unless there's that sustained drama. This is the kind of number that we should now, I guess, expect to get. And this is why we wait on the ratings, because they do provide some sort of instruction about what the public's appetite is for the series as a whole.
The NBA is not owed 20 million viewers, 18 million viewers. It's not going to die without them. It's not owed their interest. And if the NBA Finals becomes an event that starts to consistently trail the World Series, for example, well, it'll just be like it was for most of its history, right? The NBA, only in the LeBron Golden State era was the NBA out there consistently beating the World Series, consistently, not always even beating the Final Four, but getting a few wins in there. The Finals, ultimately, has really only been as big relative to the competition as it was during Jordan's era and during LeBron's 8 straight. And those are kind of exceptions to the rule. You can go back to 2003, the Marlins-Yankees World Series, I think, doubled the Nets-Spurs-NBA Finals. You know, you go back to 2007, Rockies-Red Sox didn't even do well, beat the NBA pretty handily. That was the norm. And if we're heading back into that direction, it doesn't surprise me, because a lot of why the NBA was able to beat MLB in the World Series in those years when LeBron was here is because they had LeBron every year and MLB had Madison Bumgarner. And that was not a great scenario for MLB. They, you know, other than the Cubs beating Cleveland, MLB had some rough years, very similar to what the NBA is dealing with right now.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
All right, let's shift gears now. One of the interesting things last night happened before the game. It was Rick Carlisle, the coach of the Pacers and former ESPN employee, for those of you who don't remember, he used to be an analyst there, taking up the cause of Doris Burke pregame. So we're going to play that bit of audio for you.
I saw the things that were leaked yesterday about Doris Burke, and I just want to say a couple of things. She has changed the game for women in broadcasting. Doris is a great example of courage and putting herself out there. It was just so sad to see these reports leaked, really unnecessarily, before such a celebrated event. Doris is a friend. I've asked her many times, why don't you get into coaching? She has such great knowledge. There are many women who have who she's paved the way for. I'll name a few of them. Sarah Kustak in Brooklyn, who does a great job. Lisa Byington in Milwaukee. Kate Scott, Philadelphia. Monica McNutt, New York Knicks. Katie Wingy from Denver. Zora Stevenson, Portland. Ann Myers-Drysdale, Phoenix. And Marnie Gellner does some play-by-play for games with Minnesota. So I just, I don't know what's going to happen with all that stuff, but I just want to say thank you to Doris for the example that she has put forth for young women like my daughter and all these people who are changing the game. She has changed the game. And that's the reason that she was inducted into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame a couple of years ago. So I just want to say that in support of her.
So this is an interesting comment. One, it's unusual for a coach to even be plugged into what's going on with an analyst at all. I'm honestly surprised Rick Carlisle even knew about this report by Andrew Marchand. I'm surprised he brought it up. He does take up for coaches who get fired, but that's because he's the president of the Coaches Association. There is no media. There's no union for sports media, right? I mean, none of these people are unionized. This occurred to me.
Not to my knowledge.
Well, that would be an interesting idea, wouldn't it? There's no union. There's no tie that Rick Carlisle has. They probably worked together at one point at ESPN or certainly have come across each other over the years. I have a really difficult time with the Doris part of all of this because I'm reasonably sure that probably 50, 60, maybe even 70 or 80% of the Doris criticism is just because she's a woman. But I also feel like her work this season and last is worthy of criticism and probably has not been good enough to justify being on the number one NBA broadcast team. Now, that's not to say she's impossible to improve. She's also been put in a really bad spot, as has Mike Breen, who Mike may be the best of all time. Mike Breen's work has not been as good these past 2 years because they've been put in an impossible circumstance of endless turnover. This is for Breen and Burke, their third different co-star in 2 years. And so it's tough because I do believe that criticism is warranted. She's a professional in this industry. I also feel like a lot of people probably just don't like to hear a woman's voice on sports TV, which to me, I don't think that's really justifiable anymore. So it's a tough one. I want ESPN to overhaul that lead team. I want Breen and Legler next year. I think that's the ideal scenario. And maybe we've all talked up Tim Legler too much. And when he gets a prominent role like that for a full season, we'll go, oh, there's some flaws here. But that's, to me, what I would like to see. But it's understandable why people would take up for Doris, because I do suspect a lot of it is just people who don't want to hear a woman talking about sports. What do you think, Armand?
I agree, and it's hard, because clearly she's a trailblazer. Clearly she's a legend. And so many of the plaudits she has received are deserved. But ESPN backed itself into its own corner and ESPN dug its own hole here. And in some ways, Doris Burke is feeling the heat from the decisions ESPN made that never should have been made. The problem with their lead booth is that you can't help but compare it to what was before it. You can't help but compare Breen, Burke, and Jefferson to Breen, Van Gundy, and Jackson. Tim Corrigan said this with Andrew Marchand on Marchand's podcast, and it's a very good point, and it's something I don't think a lot of people think about. Mike Breen, Jeff Van Gundy, and Mark Jackson are all in their early to mid-60s, so they're separated by 4 years. Not only are they co-workers and colleagues, they're peers, and they're around the same age. Not only have they known each other since the 90s, going back to their days with the Knicks, Jackson was drafted there, Van Gundy coached there, and Breen was broadcasting there. They're around the same age. And it showed. You could tell. With Breen, Burke, and Jefferson, you've got these three different broadcasters who have very different styles. And they work well, but they don't work all that well together. Let me put that another way. They're good broadcasters, but they're not great together. And that's the challenge. Mike Breen is not a showman like Ian Eagle. He's not a showman like Marv Albert. So Mike doesn't go as hard into trying to build these comedic moments during a broadcast as Marv Albert or Ian Eagle would. So if there's going to be levity in the broadcast, your color people have to bring it. That's where Van Gundy and Jackson were shining. Van Gundy could go off on a tangent about Rihanna. Mark Jackson could then decide whether or not he wanted to pick it up or ignore it or tag it in some way. And Breen could focus really on the nuts and bolts of the play-by-play, which is where he is at his best. Mike Breen is as nuts and bolts, and I don't say this in a derogatory way. It's actually one of his greatest strengths. Mike Breen is a very strong, straight-up nuts and bolts, almost old-school, like play-by-play announcer. He's not extremely witty. At least he doesn't try to be. He could be off the air, but that's not what he's trying to do. So you need analysts around him like a Bill Walton and Steve Jones, like a Jeff Van Gundy and a Mark Jackson. If that broadcast is going to have the color that you want it to have, the personality and the flair and the camaraderie that you want, you need those analysts to do the heavy lifting. And the problem with Burke and Jefferson is they're so different stylistically compared to Breen, and Breen is having to do more work, but they still feel like coworkers. They don't feel like friends who are working together in that way. And then frankly, the fact that there are two of them hurts, because now Breen has to be that much more careful in making sure he tees up Richard Jefferson by name, making sure he tees up Doris Burke by name. And then because you've got producers and you've got things going on, sometimes some of those things get lost in translation. But ESPN dug this hole for themselves, because you cannot leave Van Gundy and Jackson. You can't drop those announcers and expect for things to be just as good. Shame on them for trusting Doc Rivers. They have to live with that. But the Burke piece is interesting, because as great as she is and as much of a trailblazer as she is, she was at her best. She was at her best on the number two crew, or at her best when she was working on the sidelines with Van Gundy and Jackson. That's hard to say, because I don't want to give the impression that that's the only place where women can be. That's where Doris was at her best. And I think the criticisms that have been heaped upon this team this year indicate that fact.
It's also true that the first woman you give this job to isn't necessarily going to be the best who can do it. She's just the first one.
Mm-hmm.
So hire some more women.
Yeah.
Candace Parker, I think, has been very solid as an analyst.
Sarah Kustak is pretty good.
You mentioned Sarah Kustak. Kustak and Jefferson work together all the time and have excellent chemistry.
Yes, they do.
So to me, that would be perfect. I'm amazed that Sarah Kustak, the most she can do nationally is what? NFL on Fox sideline reporting for Panthers Bucks? What is going on here? You know, she's certainly good enough to do national TV.
But think about this, John. Think about this. Kustak is 43. Jefferson is 44. Mike Breen is in his 60s. So if Richard Jefferson makes a TikTok reference, or if Richard Jefferson, who's very social media conscious, if Richard Jefferson makes some sort of reference to those things, Mike Breen doesn't know what he's talking about. And so it feels like this massive generation gap. Those are the kinds of things that affect chemistry. And when you have Doris Burke and Richard Jefferson, neither analyst has really emerged as the top dog among the two. You get what I mean? When Ian Eagle, Bill Raftery, and Grant Hill work together, we know who the lead analyst really is. It's Raftery. But what Raft does is he brings Grant Hill along, and they carve out spaces for Grant Hill where he can thrive without having to carry the bulk of the analysis. That's the difference between a three-man booth like Eagle, Raftery, and Hill versus Breen, Burke, and Jefferson. Is there a leader? Like, I would say Van Gundy and Jackson in that duo, Van Gundy was the top dog. But Jackson was so good at his role as a player, from the player perspective. Jackson was very straightforward with his analysis. Van Gundy could color a lot more. And I think, frankly, he was just a better communicator of basketball than Mark Jackson was. But Jackson understood his role. That's why Jackson usually took them to break, because he was better at that. He had the catchphrases. He had a commentary and a color that added this entertainment that Van Gundy could not add. Burke and Jefferson don't have that with Breen, and it feels like three different people with different styles, and they don't mesh all that well. They do the replays well. Burke and Jefferson do a good job with replays. They can track storylines. Burke had a really great moment in game one in the first quarter. Minutes before it happened, she talked about how good a screener Isaiah Hartenstein was. And a few moments later, he sets a great screen at the top of the key for Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, and he goes on a straight line drive to the basket. That's good analysis. That was good. But it's more than that. If you're worth your weight as an analyst, you should be able to do that. But there's something else that you look for from a lead team. You look for more than that. You look for this rhythm. You look for this chemistry. You look for this ease. And Burke, Breen, and Jefferson do not have that.
You do have three very different personalities. Jefferson is perfect, you know, because Ian Eagle, you know, Ian is probably still in his 50s.
He's a showman. Yeah, he's in his 50s, yeah.
Yeah, because you were saying Breen, obviously, with the TikTok or whatever, Ian would get that. One, he's got a son who's, you know, probably keeping him abreast of those sorts of things. But, you know, Ian, Kustak, and Jefferson work really well together because they all kind of vibe in that style. Burke is actually more straight-laced. The best Doris Burke stuff is just X's and O's. She didn't show a lot of her personality before. She wasn't giving you good, fun lines, which is fine, even preferable. Tim Legler doesn't give you good, fun lines, and I wouldn't want him to start trying. So Doris is, at her best, more like Tim Legler. And a Breen and Doris booth where Doris is just doing the analysis and not trying to give you anything extra is preferable. But what happened is, and I don't know, I would be very curious what your thoughts are, because my sense has been that somewhere around 2019, I always kind of pin it at when Drake wore the Doris Burke shirt, right? But when she started to become an internet thing, when the internet people got their hands on the Doris Burke story and started really talking her up in a way that was bizarre, it feels like her approach shifted and started being less about X's and O's and started being more about the performance of those X's and O's.
I think that's a fair criticism. I know she even got into a slight controversy when she called SGA the free throw merchant. That was a thing on social media for a while. It's like Doris Burke of maybe 10 or 15 years ago wouldn't have been driving down that lane. And I do think she became maybe a little bit more aware of her popularity on social media. And as a result, she just stopped talking ball. That's what made Doris great. She just talked ball. And she did it. She's a great communicator. Oh, gosh. As an interviewer, solid. When she breaks down plays, I just mentioned this. Doris Burke is a really good analyst at breaking down replays. She's good at that. Coloring and carrying conversation, piggybacking off a thought that's being teed up by the play-by-play announcer. She's good at that. But I do think the criticisms of her are fair when you talk about how maybe she started to drink her own Kool-Aid, so to speak. And I think those are fair. When she's just talking ball, when Tim Legler is just talking ball, they're two of the best in the business. And you don't need, everybody can't be Jeff Van Gundy. Everybody can't have his kind of charisma. Everybody can't have the catchphrase skills of Clark Kellogg or Mark Jackson. And that's okay. There's room in broadcasting for all of these different styles. And I'm just sort of trying to figure out now if Doris really knows what kind of analyst she is. Because once you are, you have to pick your lane and stay in that lane. We knew what to expect from Bill Walton. We knew what to expect from Hubie Brown. Hubie Brown was not going to know anything about TikTok, wasn't going to know anything about Drake, wasn't going to know anything about these people, but he could tell you about the painted area. He could tell you about what was happening on the other side of the court while we're looking at the ball on the left side. He could tell you about why something happened on the right side and how it affected what happened on the left side. That's what we're looking for. Establish your style Stay within your style and work within that to be your best self.
Hubie, Tim Legler, those are Doris's peers as an analyst.
Yes.
She has moved away from their style to something that is more colorful and less informative. Hey, she's still in her prime as a broadcaster here. She could easily shift away from those problematic areas of trying to force the analysis in a more colorful, interesting, I guess if you want to call it that, mold. She can move away from that. And she kind of has been a little bit, right? I mean, she kind of has in recent games, certainly since that free throw merchant thing, which she should never have said. I know she defended it on an ESPN PR video the other day. She should never have said that. She has seemed to be backing away a little bit from that colorful aspect. And you know, the other thing too, I suspect, and I don't know any of this to be true, it would not surprise me if there were executives who said, hey, most people don't know the game of basketball. Don't be too technical. But that's what you're there for. So she's been a little bit more technical, I find, the last few games. To me, that's where her greatest value is. And hopefully she can keep trending in the right direction because, you know, a three-person booth of Breen, Legler, and Burke, if everyone plays to their strengths, it's not going to be the most fun booth you've ever heard. There's not going to be viral moments, but it might be, if they're all doing what they're best at, the most informative booth you've heard in a while.
Right. And it's important for, you've got to be comfortable in your own skin. And you have to know that you can't be all things as a broadcaster. Some people have it. Bill Raftery is one of one. He can hang with you. They can make jokes about his drinking and his late night carousing, and he can also break down the game with the best of them. JJ Redick couldn't do that, and it showed. So you have to be able to pick a lane as a broadcaster, as an analyst, and say, what's my style? What's my personality? And stick within that. Jefferson feels just off with that booth in particular. I want to know from ESPN, why can't Breen and Burke be your booth? Why can't the booth just be Breen and Burke? Because if you're looking for some three-person magic that you had with Breen, Van Gundy, and Jackson, it's your fault that it doesn't exist. So you would think that they would have gone in a different direction, but they clearly want a three-person booth. At least they have the last couple of years. They keep going back to it. And it keeps breaking down. I want to know why Breen Burke is not good enough. And I want to know I would love to hear Richard Jefferson tell me what his plans are, because I really think if I'm Richard Jefferson, I'm going to Amazon to go work with Ian Eagle and that crew. You've already got the chemistry and his style, his congenial style, his good-natured style. I think it fits an Ian Eagle type better than it fits that Breen Burke booth.
It's kind of like when you mix genres, right?
That's it.
You know, and Jefferson is just from a completely different style of broadcasting.
And he needs a partner who can go there with him. When Jefferson makes attempts sometimes at comedy, it doesn't feel as natural. It's like some people watch Frasier, some people watch Sanford and Son, right? Like, these are two completely different approaches to comedy, but it's comedy, right? But they're not in the same lane. You know what I mean, John? I know you.
Absolutely.
So it's like you've got to know when you're putting people together, how do they dance together? Not just are they good broadcasters, because sometimes the best individual broadcasters don't make the best teams. John Mann and Al Michaels, probably greatest analyst, greatest play-by-play announcer of all time, you could say, for the sport of football. But Madden and Summerall work better than Madden and Michaels ever did. So it's like, for the sake of the team, what do these announcers need? And then build around that. Breen worked great with Van Gundy and Jackson because they'd known each other for decades and they were all about the same age. They clearly got along. They were friends. Tim Corrigan knew it. The producer, the viewers knew it. The executives knew it. Everybody knew it. Why would you take that away from ESPN? Why would you take that away from viewers? And what did you expect to happen once you did? This is what we've been getting.
I will say the fact that Michaels worked so much better with Collinsworth than with Madden tells you everything you need to know,
exactly.
Right? No one would ever compare Collinsworth to Madden, but the chemistry was great. For the sitcom example, if you traded David Hyde Pierce for Jason Alexander, both Frasier and Seinfeld would have been far worse, right? Okay. I don't see Jason Alexander being Niles Crane, and I sure as heck don't see David Hyde Pierce being George Costanza.
No, I don't.
All right. Hey, while we're on the subject, obviously, of the coverage, a lot of people noticing this did not feel like the NBA Finals. And one of the reasons why it was so uninteresting until Tyrese and the Pacers made it interesting is the fact that you do not get the sense that you were watching a marquee game. Now, some of this is the NBA's own fault. I don't understand why this YouTube TV sponsorship deal should mean the NBA Finals logo isn't on the apron. The playoff logo is on the apron. And then you get to the finals and it's just a YouTube TV logo. I mean, I don't care that they're sponsoring the finals. I want to see the NBA Finals logo somewhere on the court. And there's no reason why this sponsorship should prevent that. You know, people talk about, it's so interesting because when the NBA put the trophy behind the logo in 2005, it felt really hokey to me because I was already a grown, well, not a grown adult. I was still a teenager, but you know, I'd watched the NBA for many years. They didn't need the logo on the court when Jordan was playing, for example. So I always thought that was excessive, and I was glad when they removed it, to be completely honest. But a lot of younger people, they really revere that very brief period, like maybe 5-6 years, where they had the giant trophy logo on the court. But, you know, it is absurd for the NBA to dress up the in-season tournament and not have any, you know, accoutrements, right? If I'm pronouncing that correctly, for the NBA Finals, it's ludicrous to not have any branding on the court or surrounding the court for the finals. I can't believe the lack of attention to detail to the aesthetic of the biggest event in the league. So a lot of that is the league's fault, but it's not only the league's fault. The games feel bigger on TNT. I mean, the games felt bigger on TNT and consistently did not feel as big on ESPN. Part of that is ESPN has completely abandoned any effort toward aesthetics. Their theme music is nonsense. They hardly even ever use it. They spend 90% of the game playing all sorts of random tunes selected for us by the tastemakers at ESPN Music, who just the other day they're bragging, "We're the first brand to lean into Lil Wayne's new album." Well, whoop-de-doo. Congratulations. We are here trying to watch a quality sports broadcast. Can you do that? Can you set that up for us? But to me, the music is a big problem. Basically everything David Roberts did, it was like, you know, Scott Layden with the Knicks, Billy King with the Sixers. I don't want to take too many shots here, but he was so miscast. And the NBA Finals is bigger than First Take, okay? So we need someone who understands how to put on a big event. They're in a transition right now from the Roberts era to Tim Corrigan taking over full-time. I really, really sincerely hope that Tim Corrigan, in his new role, makes the NBA, period, and certainly the finals, seem a lot more special than ESPN is presenting right now. Because their performance, it's unacceptable.
You said everything I was going to say. All I could think of was, where's the grandeur? Where's the pomp and circumstance? Where's the celebration? Where's the sense of significance? Can we get some player intros? I mean, can we really get us? I mean, I know Mike Breen opened the broadcast. They had the shot of the fans. Oklahoma City's fans are always electric, though. Can we get a sense of the significance of what's happening here? Player introductions, the national anthem. I mean, I know for some people it's a thing, but I would love to know were these conversations even had, right? I'm not saying anything other than that. I want the feel for the vibe. I want the atmosphere to let me know that something big has happened. ESPN's graphics are subpar. The music is dreadful. It's dreadful. What they had the couple of years ago, that theme they had for about almost 20 years, it should have kept that, man. I mean, there's so many things ESPN has done just poorly that TNT has an advantage on them with. And I need more than just a little gold box or a silver box around the score bug to let me know that something big is going on. Give me a sense of significance. Allow me to feel how heavy, how weighty this event is. ESPN just doesn't deliver in that way. And I do agree that the NBA also has a lot to say about that.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, David Stern would not allow this to happen. You know, Tom Tolbert wears a suit David Stern doesn't like. ESPN hears about it. And you know something? Tom Tolbert's career on national TV ended.
Yeah.
Right? I don't know if it was because of the suit alone, but David Stern was, you know, Adam Silver just doesn't have that. Adam Silver the other day, he went on Breakfast Ball. What in the world is a commissioner of the NBA doing on an FS1 morning show? They aren't a rights holder. Okay? Not only are they not a rights holder, Fox has been pretty antagonistic toward the NBA. Its coverage of the NBA is almost always negative and intended to tear down the players.
Mm-hmm.
And Fox itself, because of the political aspect, has certainly no fond feeling for the NBA. What are you doing on that show? I mean, wow, I couldn't believe that. You know, the thing is, David Stern was going out there fighting Jim Rome, fighting Rudy Martsky. He was getting down into the mud, the contentious interviews with Dan Patrick, the palaver, you know? And I think Adam Silver is mostly a good commissioner, but his public face is one of someone who you can say the worst things about the NBA and he'll go, you know, that might be reasonable. You know, yeah, you know who he reminds me of?
Who?
Barack Obama. Now, I see your expression. Maybe I shouldn't go further. I'll leave it at that. Okay? You know, I mean, every day in the NBA is a beer summit. And I just don't understand why Adam Silver is giving the time of day to Fox Sports One. So, look, it also comes down to not understanding that this league does mean something to people on an irrational level and meeting people at that irrational level of wanting to believe that a game in June means more than a game in October. That's not really rational. It's all just basketball. But we buy into the idea that a game in June, on June 5th, means something different than a game in April and a game in February, and that there should be something that signifies that this meant something to people, right? It's different. But the problem with Adam Silver, he's very academic. He's kind of aloof from those irrational things. He sees the NBA as kind of just a product that is, it's a pragmatic product where everyone's just trying to make money and have the business run in a fashion that allows everyone to be enriched and to run efficiently as well. So you don't have to do those extra things if the show is going to be working properly without them. But it is those extra things that matter. And so for the NBA, the game one of the finals didn't feel like the finals. It was only the play that made it feel that way. And you say, well, that's the way it should be. But no, because one, the play certainly has not been making it feel like the finals lately. So somebody's got to do it. And on those occasions when you don't have miraculous comebacks and incredible clutch play, it's probably important to have something else there that signifies that it's an important time of year for the league.
Yeah, and just to jump back on that point, production matters as well. There is a significant difference between Joe Tessitore and Booger McFarlane calling a playoff game. There's a difference in Steve Levy, Louis Riddick, and Brian Griese doing a playoff game versus Joe Buck and Troy Aikman. All of those things matter. All of them matter. That's why you go and get a Tom Brady if you're Fox. Because you want it to feel like something. You want it to be big. And between the NBA and ESPN, the finals do not feel as big as they should. Heck, the World Series felt bigger with Fox.
The Women's College World Series feels bigger.
I can't argue that, John. I cannot argue that. There's, oh, man. It's like we could go on and on and on about just how the NBA and ESPN have fumbled this. And it's been happening for a while, but the grandeur needs to return. And I don't know what ESPN and the NBA are going to do to bring it back, but it's lacking.
I'm glad you brought up that Monday Night Football group they had. During the John Skipper era, it was clear that ESPN kind of weirdly didn't care about the NFL at all, right? It was just clear, oh yeah, let's put anyone on Monday Night Football. And eventually Roger Goodell said, who do you people think you are? And the NFL, in some ways that are uncomfortable and ways that I don't necessarily think are good, made sure ESPN understood, no, you're not going to treat us like this. If I'm ESPN, the goal next season is we're putting on the best NBA broadcast out there. You can have Michael Jordan. You can have Dirk and Nash or whatever. We are the ones that will be putting on the NBA broadcast of record. We were second to TNT for more than 20 years. They're gone. We are not letting NBC and Amazon beat us. But honestly, I think their thought process is, we have the rights, whatever. I don't see there being the level of attention to detail that there currently is to the NFL that wasn't even there until the NFL forced the issue.
If you can have that level of pride in all the money they spent, John, Eli Manning, Peyton Manning, Peyton, who just won another Emmy, I think he has two, Eli Manning, who's been nominated at least, Aikman, Buck, you spent tens of millions of dollars to improve your production because you understand how important it is that the NFL on ESPN, Monday Night Football, has as great a product, a television product, as possible. Why has this mindset not been applied to the NBA? And who is going to come in, if anyone, who's going to come in and shake things up to the degree that ESPN says, we've got to do better? We can keep Breen. We can keep probably Dave Pasch and maybe Mark Jones. Those, they're three solid, if not good to great, play-by-play announcers. But we got to do some serious evaluating of our team, some serious evaluating of graphics and music and flow and feel and vibe, and make some changes because they are necessary.
I sincerely, truly do hope that they improve. And nothing would make me happier than to come back here in a year and be able to say, I can't complain about ESPN's NBA coverage. That would be a wonderful outcome for me just as a viewer. Well, that will do it for the SMW podcast this week. Games 3 and 4 of the NBA Finals. I will be in Indianapolis, or that's the plan, next week. Ben Huddleston is in OKC. And so we'll be giving you coverage from both sites of the NBA Finals, which continues Sunday. And we'll talk more about the series and everything else in sports media next week on the SMW podcast. So thank you to Armand for joining me. And thank you all for listening. We'll be back with more stuff.
Tired of the price of everything going up these days? Groceries, rent, you name it. It's all going up. But not at Metro. They've got your back. Metro has lowered their prices and are giving you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. One line, now 20% lower. Family plans, also lowered. Oh, and you also get a free 5G phone. All with no ID required and no activation fees. Stop by your neighborhood Metro store, visit metrobytmobile.com, or call to find out about their amazing offers. Bring your number, not available if currently at T-Mobile or with Metro in the past 180 days. Guarantee covers monthly price of on-network talk, text, and 5G data for customers activating on an eligible plan. Exclusions apply. Details at metrobytmobile.com.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.